When I entered basic flight training, after coming on active duty, I did very well. Had a good time flying a T-28 down in Moultrie, Georgia, out in the middle of nowhere. And Mary and I were fairly newly married. We just had been married a little over a year. The world was very rosy. We were having a terrific time. Went on over to Webb Air Force Base in Texas and began flying a jet, T-33. Had a good time, doing well. And then all of a sudden, all within a span of 5 days, I washed out of flight training in a formation jet flight phase. It just kind of hit me like a whole bucket of cold water. I had failed at something. I never had recalled failing in my life before. It was beyond my control. It wasn't bad, but it was, and I didn't know it at the time. It was a time when they just didn't need a whole lot of people. You know, they go in swings in the Air Force. And I just didn't fly formation flight in the jets that well. And so within, I think it was just 5 days or something like that, I blew a check ride, came up, one more flight, re-examined, out into a board, and was out of the entire program. And I was straight at the bottom of myself. I say, you know, what is God doing to me? I was walking with the Lord. I was in the Word. As best as I knew, we were trying to do everything that God wanted us to do, but I had failed. And I didn't know exactly what God was trying to teach me personally. And we prayed and asked the Lord to lead us from that point on. It was a totally different outlook on an Air Force career than I had expected. And so when I was offered to go continue in a flight capacity as a navigator, Mary and I prayed and turned that down and felt that that our only motive in doing that would be because you get more money. And we knew that that was not right before God. So I just put my name in the hopper and said, give me an engineering assignment somewhere. And for a number of weeks, I sat around wondering what the future would hold. I think it took us 4 or 5 weeks before I came up with an assignment and then was sent to Cape Kennedy, to the Space Flight Center. And it was a tremendous surprise, and I was looking forward to that. And, of course, I had no idea that God would completely redirect my life as a result of a failure. As Mary and I have looked back on it, had that not happened, I would have had 2 tours in Vietnam flying because my class had at least that. Likely I'd have gotten killed because I don't think that was I was that good of a pilot. And God would probably not have had me go around the circuit to go into the educational end of things and come out to the Air Force Academy, and just a whole series of things would have been an impossibility in terms of my career, which God very clearly led in and brought us to the point where we are right now. And so as I look back and say, failure, what does it really mean? Well, it means, for one thing, that God may in a very clear way be totally redirecting a life. One thing is certain in life. They say death and taxes, and may I add one other thing, failure. Every single one of us are going to fail. It's not if you fail, but it's when you fail. And I'd be interested, how many of you in here, as far as you look back in your lives right now, and you can look to some key point, in fact, it kind of goes in like a knife into you, that you know you've experienced some kind of a failure, that it's very clear, it's not maybe, it is. Can I just see your hand just a second? Something in your life, okay? Most of us have had that kind of a situation, but it'll come again. It's not generally just one time. The question is not if you fail, as I said, but when you fail. But then the real question is, when you fail, what do you do? How you handle failure may determine whether you ever succeed in your life, in your secular work, or in your own personal Christian life. Or if you just give up, either in your Christian life or in your secular work. There are two kinds of failure that we must learn to cope with, and which probably every one of us will encounter. The first is that kind of failure which God, in His sovereignty, brings into your life. You've done all that you know to do, but yet things seem to go wrong. We call those trials, you know, losing a job, being turned down for a job, whatever it may be. And God, we're just totally out of our control. So far as we can determine, we did nothing either to deserve it. When we examine our past, we say, now, God, as far as I know, before You, I have been walking with You. I have done nothing where this would be punishment. But yet it comes. The second kind of failure is failure that is a result of sin in your life. That is, you choose a path or a decision, and God brings into your life a result of that choice. Galatians 6 speaks of that. It says that we will have to reap the fruit of what we have sown. And so as a man sows, so shall he reap. And so God will bring into one's life many times failure. Some of you may at one point or another in your life be in open sin and turned away from God. You may be greatly discouraged because things are just falling to pieces in your lives. Maybe that there's been an unhappy marriage or may have been divorce that has occurred. Things that in many ways are irreversible. But yet God has given us very clear instructions in the Scriptures on how to handle failure. In fact, the Bible is full of people who failed. Most people that God has used in the Scriptures have failed in some way. And not just a tiny little bit. I mean, their lives have been disasters. You can't exactly say that David's sin with Bathsheba was minor. And you can't exactly say that hiding in caves was a thing that you would say would be the thing for training for an up-and-coming king. You can't exactly say that running out of the city in disgrace with his son trying to take over his kingdom and one of his friends throwing rocks at him and spitting at him is exactly the way you'd want to have a good kingdom run. And as you go through the Bible, you look again and again and again and say, well, God must be doing something. You can't exactly say that Peter did right when he denied Jesus Christ. And you can't say that he ever felt good in his life again because of what happened. There's at no point in his life could he look back and say, I'm glad I did that. You see what I mean? That God allows things, or as a result of what we do, brings things into our lives that are disastrous. Now, I have chosen just one of perhaps a dozen characters and a dozen places in the Scriptures to turn to demonstrate how God instructs us to handle failure, and I've chosen Joseph. And so as we look at Joseph, I won't spend a great deal of time with his story, but we read in verse chapter 37, now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. And these are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. While he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a many-colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers his dream, they hated him even more. And basically his dream, everybody knew the interpretation, he had it twice, was that eventually his brothers and his father would bow down to him and worship him or do obeisance to him in some way. And like a rather impulsive youth, he told them this. And apparently, Joseph had a great promise. And that's the first section of Joseph's story. He had great promise. He apparently was a very gifted person. He was in position in his family better than anyone else. He had experienced luxury. He'd experienced ease. He'd experienced blessing. He'd experienced everything in his life. But he was probably a spoiled brat. You know, very likely, he was a kid who you would just like to take over your knees and whack him when you saw him. That's what it appears to be. But yet God, in some way, was preparing this young guy for something in the future. His mistake was that he shared openly how good he was or these things that he had. Now, you know, we have a great promise as far as what Jesus Christ has done in our lives. He has promised us peace and happiness and blessing, success, prosperity, many things. And especially he's promised us that we would inherit eternal life with him. Now the question I have, do we just take it for granted or do we act like Joseph and say, well, I deserve it because I was born into it or whatever the case may be? But then later on in the chapter, as you go down and read, that because of their hatred of Joseph, his brothers, when he came out to bring a message or bring them some food, check on them for his father, they spotted him and said, let's kill him. And so they agreed they were going to kill him. But one of his brothers talked them out of killing him. And so instead of killing him, it was Reuben, I believe, he says, let's throw him into this pit and leave him, and let the wild beasts kill him. That way we won't be directly responsible. And then, while they were coming along and just deciding what to do, a band from Egypt came by, and they said, let's sell him to those people as a slave. So they got him out of the pit, and they sold him to these men from Egypt, and he went on into Egypt and was sold to Potiphar as his slave. Now, I can't exactly think that promise that God had given would be very real to Joseph at this point in his life. Here he sits, almost killed, sold as a slave, taken away from his country, into a strange country, and under bondage, for all he could tell, for his entire life, to a man by the name of Potiphar. And I think of a number of people who have gone through circumstances like that. Jim Irwin, who's in our church, went through a situation in his life. How many of you have heard his testimony, by the way? A few of you have. Jim, when he was a young captain, I believe, was flying a light plane, crashed it, was totally broken up. They said, you'll never fly again. You'll be lucky if you walk again. Is in the hospital and I think was off flying status for almost a year. Months, as I understand it, if I remember the story correctly, in a hospital. But he determined that he would get well and he would fly and that he would become an astronaut. And of course, you know that he has. So he did not let the failure get him down. I have a friend who has had a deep influence in my life in Spokane, Washington, a man by the name of Bud Ponting. Bud has every disadvantage that you could probably want to have in your life, or ever expect to have in your life. He's a spastic, and he's a serious spastic. When he was in high school, he could not even be understood with his speaking. But he disciplined himself and took a hymn book and learned to enunciate by singing hymns. And then he went into the printing business. And I worked for him, and he was also my Sunday school teacher at one time while I was in high school. And you don't expect high schoolers, you know, they say, well, you don't associate with someone with that kind of problem. But he loved kids, and for all his life, as far as I've known, he's been involved in running a Sunday school or teaching a class. His insurance people would say, you just can't spend all this money driving those kids around everywhere if you're going to keep your business going. Bud taught me how to set type. And to watch him run a letter press was something else. And he would go just take the hands in and out of the press, but he did good work. And I learned from Bud's life discipline. When finally he got run out of business, he had to take a very heavy job. He's a big guy. He's about 6'2", and he taught me how to play tennis. You can imagine him doing that, but because of his long strides, he'd take about a 5-foot step sometimes, you know, and I called him 3 weeks ago, and because of an industrial accident, his whole foot and the way his weight shifted got smashed, his heels. He's been off for 4 years, and he's been applying to a mission board, incidentally. In fact, we may think of having him apply to the NAS because he's a printer. But he said, well, I think I can get back out on the tennis courts again. And he just keeps pressing on. So far as anybody could determine, Bud Fontaine has not been a success in his life. But God has deeply used Bud in my life and in the lives of probably hundreds of kids that he gives himself to week after week after week. In fact, he's so right now, when I talk to him, he's so impatient at not being able to work that his son has a paper route. So he gets up at 3 in the morning to cover the far end. He says, now, I can't tell my son this, but I sure hope he doesn't stop the route because I really need that exercise, he says, to get out and go after that. So, you know, I see this guy, and I could tell you others, that life has looked like it was a wreck. But God has used them. And it depends entirely on whether one is willing to accept the circumstances. Then we come to the next section of Joseph's life in Genesis 39. In Genesis 39, I have a little section that I call Temporary Success. Chapter 39, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord had caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. And as we see this circumstance of Joseph now coming out of defeat, and all of a sudden getting success, even as a slave, God was honoring him, and he made his master prosper. And the question I would ask you, does your employer prosper because of your presence? Because that's exactly what Joseph did. And so we go on through the story in Genesis 39, and we find out that even though he was in charge of everything, apparently he was a very handsome young man, and Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. And she tried to get him to sin, and she pestered him day after day after day. And finally, one day, she caught him alone and tried to get him to sin with her. He refused, ran out of the house. She grabbed his outer tunic, and it fell off, and he ran away, and then she accused him. Now, have you ever been accused of doing something that you did not do? Have you ever taken the blame for a wrong that you know in your heart you never had any part in at all, or any responsibility, or even any intent? That's what Joseph did. He took it straight on the nose. And there was no way he could do anything about it. He was a slave. But yet he accepted what happened. Now, Joseph was faithful to God. He had success. But in the midst of success, temptation will always come. There are two possibilities that occur with Joseph here. One is that he was absolutely innocent of everything. But there's a slight other possibility that has to be considered, to be honest with this passage. And that is, Joseph, knowing that this was a problem, perhaps could have avoided being in her presence without someone else being there. You see what I mean? Now, I don't believe he had any intent. As far as we can determine, there's no problem. But he may well have put himself in an unwise circumstance. And I think we need to learn some lessons from that. We need to learn that there are certain things that we ought to keep ourselves out of. because of the impact it may have in temptation for sin or whatever the case might be. It's a little story that an alcoholic doesn't go into a beer joint to have a Coke. You know, you just avoid it. A person who's had a problem with pornography or something of that nature does not browse around magazine racks and so forth. You can go on down the line that you avoid circumstances in which temptation is very great, especially if you know you're susceptible. One warning ought to be enough from God. And so we must consider the possibility that Joseph perhaps is a little unwise in certain of his conduct here. Nevertheless, we have to see that Joseph did not do anything wrong, so far as we can tell from the record in Scripture. Now, it's interesting to me that when success comes, temptation always comes with it. If you are successful in one thing, there's the danger of pride. And someone will always be attempting to get you to compromise your stand for Jesus Christ. A little lie, a little cheating. Don't witness now, you might not get the job. Try a little bit of sin. No one will know. And on and on. And folks, it's that little sin that leads to the big sins. And we in our lives must guard against those little compromises that we clearly know from our conscience and from the Word are not right. Every time in my life when I have, so to speak, not told the whole truth, in terms of defending myself or something I'd done wrong, whether it's in the Air Force or whatever wherever the case may have been, anytime I tried to shade it away from the absolute exact facts, I have gotten burned. And, you know, what is done in the darkness will be revealed in the light. It will come to pass. Watergate happens in everybody's lives. You know, that some things are going on, you think no one will ever find out. But they do, in some way and in some fashion. And so I believe God has to warn us that we must be very, very careful. Proverbs 4:19-20, enter not into the path of the wicked and go not in the way of evil men. Avoid it, pass not by it, turn from it, and pass away. There are times that the response to sin and temptation is to run like crazy. To just turn and run. And that's the right thing to do. Joseph ran, but he was still condemned. And he was put in prison, and as far as he could tell, failure again. Now, the question I would just present in terms of failure to you is, are you willing to be faithful to God no matter what the cost might be? I remember a little incident I shared earlier, I think, in this lesson on reality, one of the experiences I had in jump training. When I went down with the Army while I was still in the Air Force and went through their training, we had a little sergeant about yay tall, just as wiry as he could be, you know, muscles everywhere, and you knew that that guy was in good shape. He also knew the Lord, I found out as I talked to him. He probably had, I don't know, 15 years service, I would guess. And he went through all the training, and we went through all the emergency procedures, exactly what to do, exactly how to fall. And you could have ignored those, says, oh, good night, you've got two chutes, there's no big deal. The one major malfunction of the hundreds of jumps we made in that whole class was this sergeant. He jumped out of the plane, his chute went into a cigar roll type of thing, and so he activated, falling very fast, activated his second chute. His second chute did what it's not supposed to do, went up inside the other chute. He didn't get it out on the outside, and he was coming down somewhere between 3 and 5 times as fast as one ought to hit. But he was in shape, and he was prepared, and he hit the ground right. And he didn't have a bruise. And he didn't break anything. Didn't hurt himself at all. In fact, as a matter, as far as I can remember, the only person that was hurt was a guy who came in a very normal jump and just landed wrong. He hadn't paid attention. And it seems to me, as I see that kind of thing, that all of us will come into places in our lives where something very unexpected happens. And we do not have time to either study the Scriptures, be godly, have a good quiet time, learn what the right response ought to be. But when the incident happens, it's your training that will get you through. And if you have practiced a life of compromise, then you will go that route when the incidents happen in your life. And so I believe God teaches us that we must prepare by that daily time in the Word of God, that daily time of hiding the Scriptures, praying, of resisting sin, of witnessing, so that when the time comes where we are confronted in our lives by either failure, sin, problems, that our reaction is a godly reaction and not a flesh reaction. So it isn't so much what you do at the moment, but it's what happens up to that moment that determines how you react in a time of failure. God sometimes is very gracious and gives us time, but sometimes He doesn't. The third section is what I entitle, as you can tell there, Wait on God. In Genesis 39, 20 through 22, well, let me go through the rest of it. You remember the story here that when Joseph was in prison, before you knew it, he was in charge of the whole prison. That he was so trustworthy that the head jailer turned everything in the prison over to him. And in the process, there was the baker and the butler of the Pharaoh who apparently were being accused of having tried to do away with their boss. And they were both thrown into prison. While they were in prison, that they had these dreams. And so Joseph interpreted their dreams. And the chief cupbearer or the butler told him his dream, and then the baker told him his dreams. And then the baker, I believe it was, I'm looking through here, and just know the cupbearer was restored to his office, and the baker was hung. And he told them exactly what would happen. And then he says, now when you leave here, remember me to your boss, to the Pharaoh. And of course they went out, the one was hung and the other went back to his place. And of course when success is there, why should you remember what was done in the past? And they forgot him. And so he sat and rotted in prison. Now, you know, it wasn't this kind of a thing, well, man, a day or two and God will be with it. It was 2 years. I mean, 2 years. That he was sitting in that rotten Egyptian prison, and I don't care if he did run it, I don't think it was too pleasant. And from what we know about prisons, they were not exactly the place to be in those times. And I can imagine Joseph sitting there and saying, God, you gave me that promise. You've never taken that promise away. Here I've done everything I know. I've served you. I've been faithful. I have not sinned so far as I know. And yet you brought me through all of this terrible thing. When are you going to really get me out of this? And in fact, I told these two guys exactly what was going to happen, and I thought that was how you were going to use to get me out of here, because who else can interpret dreams? You know, that's not exactly a minor miracle. And so, you know, he could have just sat there and fumed and destroyed himself. But apparently he didn't. Apparently, he just kept right on serving the chief jailer. And so the question I would ask, when the going is really tough, I mean when things are really bad, are you willing to wait on God? Psalm 27, verses 13 and 14 would be the areas that I would mention there. Now, let's just do a little analysis of Joseph and his circumstances and see what Joseph did and what our response would have been, and from that try and get some guidelines on how to handle failure. Then I'd like to do a little on how to handle success. Most of you say, man, don't worry about that one. Just concentrate on a failure bit. But if you don't learn how to handle success, you probably will not handle failure. The first thing we note is that Joseph accepted his circumstances. Nowhere do we find that Joseph complained or grumbled, but that's exactly what we would have done. The minute something like what happened to Joseph happened, we would begin accusing something. We always look for somewhere to dump our failure. Now, Joseph had nowhere. Now, I think Joseph really learned some things through this. I think he probably reflected back on his rather spoiled childhood and realized that something was haywire. But he accepted his circumstances, and if you'll recall back to that lesson on accepting circumstances, that is one of the key areas that we must accept circumstances that we're in, unless there is part of sin where we have to get out of them. But circumstances are going to train us. The second thing is he didn't compromise. That no matter what the circumstances are, he did not compromise. Now, our tendency is to get ahead at any cost and say, well, Jerry, we're Christians. We really don't do that. Well, I suspect that in our lives, we do try and do that. And we try and shave the corners. And we try and play both ends against the middle, so to speak. And we don't do it in the world sense, perhaps, but yet that tendency is there in our lives. The third thing is that Joseph was willing to wait. Wait for what? I don't think he knew. I think just willing to wait. In the meantime, he did a number of things, and I'll get to that in a moment. But we are in the business of being impatient. We want it now. I remember, in fact, Jerry probably in this circumstance right now, sitting at the academy waiting for my assignment to come through. And I was praying that God would reassign us to Colorado Springs here. And that was very important because of the ministry. At that point, God had given us direction to get out, and I felt that this would be the best assignment. And I can remember at least two distinct instances where I picked up the phone and called a military personnel center down in San Antonio, and they gave me some very distressing news, that you are not going there. And, you know, my stomach just fell out. I was sick the rest of the day. Going and giving lectures was, you know, it was just terrible. And I said, now, Jerry, this is stupid. You preach on this sort of stuff. Why do you feel like this? You're not supposed to react like that. But I was so impatient. I wanted this thing resolved now. I wanted to know that I was going there. I did not want to wait. And I've had that more than once in my life. In fact, I'd hate to count how many times I've had that in my life. But when you had the circumstances coming in on top of you, and you wanted them resolved immediately. Well, all I know is that in the process of waiting, the one thing that did was to drive me to God and reveal to myself how unspiritual I really was in my reaction, and gave me time to deal with some issues in my own life. Whereas if it just happened and blopped, you know, it was resolved immediately, I wouldn't have time to worry. When you don't have time to get an ulcer, you don't get one. And so, you know, if you're going to go that route of worrying about everything, then you need time, and I believe God will allow, just have you wait. But we need to be able to wait for either success or for marriage or for whatever the circumstance may be in your life. Now, in the midst of this, Joseph was faithful to God. Our response is to be faithful to ourselves. You know, number one first. But Joseph, really, I believe in this, was faithful to God. In every instance, as far as I know, that, for instance, in 39, chapter 39, his master saw that the Lord was with him. Well, how do you see that? He must have known that Joseph worshipped God, and Joseph said, now listen, my success is not from myself. Thought the Lord was with him. The next thing is he didn't become bitter. Our tendency is to blame others. And the other thing is that he worked hard. He really hit it. What he had to do, he did well, and our tendency is to give up. I remember an incident that happened when I washed out of flying training. They assigned me temporarily to a civil engineering squadron. I knew nothing about civil engineering until one course I'd taken in college. And so I got in this squadron, and they were used to having this. People washed out of flight training right and left, and you had to sign them somewhere on base. So they either ran PT or they ran this or that. Well, I went to this squadron. So they had guys like that before. And they knew that what they came and did was to sit down and sort of bide their time and diddle around and come into work and take a long lunch hour. And I don't know why I did this, but I just really went to work. In fact, within a week, I replaced a man that went on vacation. And God very uniquely gave me a witness of these people, and they were amazed. They could not figure out why I would work when I was only going to be there a month and carry the load that I happened to carry. I didn't intend to. It just happened. And they just could not believe it. And one of the guys in the civil engineering squadron was a Christian and a good friend, and he gave me the feedback that this was a witness. Because they'd seen guy after guy who just said, oh, nuts, you know, I'm going to be here 5 weeks. I'm just going to piddle around. And did. And they just accepted it. So the question is, when you are in a point of failure and are down, how do you react in terms of your job? And that's where I'm applying this quite a bit. Do you work hard? Do you give up? Do you have a short-timer's attitude, so to speak? And, of course, as I mentioned, Joseph's employer always prospered because of his presence. And I really like that concept. It's not mine, by the way. A fellow by the name of Jolie Holt shared that with me when I was over speaking at his conference in Germany recently. Okay, now let me just point out several areas where Satan will try to force failure on our part. The first is in the area of marriage. If he can upset your marriage, either by conflict between you and your husband or wife, or with circumstances with the children, that is the first area, if you're married, that he will get into. The second, and I'm not sure these are in exact order of priority, by the way, so don't take that too seriously, and I give you some verses on these. The second is in the area of sexual sin that starts first in the mind. And whether you're married or whether you're not, that Satan will try and get you to sin in this area, either mentally or actually. The third is in the area of money, to get your focus on money. And it doesn't matter how much you've got. Your focus can still get on money. The fourth is in the area of laziness. If Satan can get you to be lazy, in some area of your life, you know, in your own walk with God, in your job or whatever, the battle starts to get you to fail through that. The fifth is in the relationship to parents. Now, I prime this mainly to single people, but I think that those of us who are married also have some things in that regard. The sixth, and certainly not the bottom, maybe the top, is abandoning the basics of the Christian life. When things get too busy, you just don't get time to read the Word. That it doesn't have the priority in your life, and that obedience that comes through that daily walk with God disappears when things get bad. I mean, it is not sufficient when you get in trouble to turn to the book of Psalms. It really isn't. I mean, it's very comforting. But unless you've built some foundations out of Galatians and Romans and other parts of the Old Testament and the Gospels, and have built some things in the area of your own personal lordship, it's not sufficient just to kind of turn to God in desperation, though God does listen in those points, but just to get comfort for the moment. It happens earlier when you abandon things. And the last is if Satan can get you to not accept who you really are, to realize your own gifts and abilities and limitations and positive things and so forth. And if you cannot do that, then you will be headed for a point of failure. Now, back on the previous page, is how to evaluate failure. I would like to help you in just a moment, some things that I believe you can do when you fail that will help you evaluate it. Okay, here is what I would recommend you're doing. The first is to accept the circumstances. Don't fight that circumstance. It's there and you cannot change it. You cannot change it. The second thing is to take a little pad of paper and write this down. What can I learn? You know, what are possible things that God may be teaching me out of it? And you can come at that from several perspectives. That is, you can look back and you can say, now, a little bit of why did this come about? What could God be teaching me? Is he teaching me patience? Is he teaching me faithfulness in the basics? Is he teaching, saying, hey, before I give you success in the job, I want you to get your family squared away. Have a biblical relationship in the family, or whatever it may be. You can start asking questions. What could it possibly be that God is teaching me? The next thing you have to say is, was it my fault? I see bitter people all over who simply will not admit that they really blew it and say, hey, I did wrong. And the reason I am where I'm at is because I did not do my job. Or I did not put the right priority in my family, or I did not, and so forth. To really realize if it really was your fault and you had control, to admit that. And then the fourth is to make a determination before God as to press on with whatever new direction he gives you at that particular point. And there are passages. 1 Corinthians 15:58 would be one to jot down in that area. Okay, now I would like to discuss for just a moment with you, and I don't have this written out on a slide, which is the reason that I put it into the handout here, is how to proceed from this point on. Okay, now those were how to evaluate, but now is how to proceed. Okay, the first thing is to do this evaluation. Never miss a lesson that God may want to give you in the circumstance. The second thing is, in the midst of this, be faithful in the basics. Does that word communicate to you? I use it so frequently, the basics of the Christian life. I just mean your personal devotional life, prayer, an intake of the Scriptures, obeying God in what you know. See, obedience in the areas of lordship, making Christ the central part of your life. See, the basics of the Christian life. The third thing is, whatever you do, don't become bitter. Don't become bitter. It doesn't help anybody. And it wrecks your life and gives you ulcers. Okay, and the fourth thing is just be willing to wait. There may be things you need to do to act, but be willing to wait on God to see where he directs. The fifth thing is, if there are some corrections you need to make in your life or your job or whatever, do it. And the last thing, what you do, work hard at it. Now, that doesn't mean by good work and hard work. It doesn't mean to double your efforts will always get the job done. It may be you have to cut back and do fewer things better. But it does mean that you do what you do well, regardless of the circumstances. So that's that point. Now, let me just go to one other thing on handling success. I'm not going to spend as much time on that, because most people don't quite see as much need. Okay, handling success. First of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that God is the source of any success that you have. In 1 Corinthians, and I may not be able to get that passage out of my mind right now, I didn't write it down, it says, what do you have that was not given to you? And if it was given to you, why do you boast as though it was not given to you? See? Everything you have is of God. If you have success, it's of God. 4:7, is it? Yeah. For who regards you as superior? And what do you have that you did not receive? But if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? See, everything we have is what we've gotten from God. And if I have an ability, it is not my ability. Now, unfortunately, I usually get the credit. Or you usually get the credit. But that's the reason we must acknowledge the source. Now, I don't mean you have to go around saying, oh, God did it, God did it, God did it, that sort of thing. But what I do mean is your demeanor of life has to be God-honoring. As you are going about, that everyone knows in some way, just by your life, that God is the source of your life. The second thing is just to be thankful. Most people who are successful are not particularly thankful. They keep seeing the areas that they're not successful and say, God, why'd you do this? It's kind of like someone interviewed one time the most strikingly beautiful women in the world. None of them were satisfied with their appearance. They did not believe that they really were beautiful, and they rather dwelt on those things which in their features they did not like. Probably as Barbara Streisand, and she has a big nose. So she probably says, oh, I just can't stand my big nose or something. Okay? The fourth one is one I've already said, is keep faithful in the basics. It's just as easy in success to abandon your walk with God when things are going well. Don't worry about God. The fifth is to guard jealously against pride. God's usually very faithful to bring enough failure into our lives to help us to keep the pride thing in focus. But it's still something you must guard against. And the sixth is that I totally believe that God never gives success without a purpose for witness. And if you have success, if you're getting promoted fast, if you can do something well, it must always be a platform for witness. That you use it to share Jesus Christ. I have absolutely no problem with a man like Jim Irwin getting up and sharing his testimony and knowing that people are listening, not because of his testimony, but because of what he did. Now, if Jim is not careful in terms of keeping his own life and walk before God, he could misuse it. But I say, God's given him that platform. Or I see other men, a General William K. Harrison, who is an outstanding Army officer, using that as a platform of what he said. Or Senator Harold Hughes, is that it? From Iowa. Or Charles Colson. God has somehow brought them all through a measure of both success and failure and given them a particular platform. Now, every one of us has some kind of a platform from which we speak. And if it's a platform of success, then I think that's important that we use it in that context. Now, the foundations, and I have a thing that I call foundations for failure. Three things that I believe you must prepare in if you are going to be used by God in the midst of failure. The first is to simply ask, is Christ really Lord of your life, or are you just playing the Christian game? And I bring that up very bluntly because around a fundamental church, an evangelistic church like ours, it's so easy for appearances to deceive and for Christ not really to be Lord of our lives. The second thing is your life based on God's Word. And I don't mean from the pulpit. I mean from your own personal walk with God, that you are in the Word and reading and praying. Jot down Philippians 4, 12 through 15. Now, are you publicly committed to God and to His Word? Okay? And then I would say the third thing is to always have in mind that no failure is fatal and no failure is final. But you can let it be, and so you then have to, in this third thing, evaluate where is your life going? You know, what is the goal of your life? Do you know where God is leading you in terms of your own personal ministry? So it's not whether you'll fail, it's that you will. But success is how you react when you do fail. And walking with God in the midst of hard times, there are few men of God that I have seen who have not been through some of the most difficult and devastating times in their life. There are few men of God that are really being used by God who have not been through very difficult times. In fact, many times I look in my life and I say, I'm not sure I've really been through difficult times. And I wonder what God is going to have to take me through to really purify my life in many ways. And so be thankful when those things come. And I think the illustration of Job would be something. So I personally believe there's no success without failure. You know, we failed God's standard, and so sin came, and Christ had the result. We fail to reach God by our works, and so we have to turn to total dependence on God. We fail to be happy by the world's means, and so we have to turn to God's means. So real success is learning to walk with God no matter what happens. So let me just open it up for a couple minutes of questions that you may want some clarification in these. Yes. Okay? Right. Now, that's true. The first thing is recognition. If you recognize pride, that's the first point. Confess it to God and say, now, God, what can I do to guard against it? But the best thing that I know to guard against pride is to be deep in the Word. See, if you understand the doctrine of grace, and if you understand the real position that man had before God and what you really deserve, I mean, you understand that in the sense of Romans 7 and in the really Romans 5 through 7. If you understand God and His perspective of you and who you really are, and then understand His grace, I believe that is one of the greatest combatants against pride in one's life.